Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Theology on Tuesday. We're going to get started. So go ahead and grab a seat. We still have plenty of pizza, I believe. And I think John is behind the bar, maybe. But we're glad that you are here. My name is Justin. This is Brian. And you're at Theology on Tuesdays. If it's your first time, you'll see these little sheets of paper around the room. This top QR code is the way that at any point this evening, you can scan that and text in anonymously any question you want. And we will have the second half of our time up here devoted to answering as many of those questions as we can. We always love getting some. Sometimes they're related to what we talk about. Sometimes they're not. And it's always, you never know what you're going to get. It's fun. You can also join our email list by this bottom left QR code. Stay up to date on all things Theology on Tuesday. We also, if you're looking for a place for a Christmas Eve service, we would love for you to join us. Mainly because we have been out of our sanctuary for a very long time, and it's just now renovated. And it will open up on December 24th. We will have a service at 7:30 and at 10:30 with candlelight and full choir and orchestra. It will be over the top, as it always is, but even more so because it's fully renovated and glorious.
Yes.
Any other announcements that I'm missing tonight before we jump into our topic?
I think that's it.
Wonderful. All right, well, what are we talking about tonight?
So we are talking tonight about keeping Christmas. And if you have ever read Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, you will remember that line about keeping Christmas from there. But keeping Christmas is one of the things that our culture, I would argue, is really bad at. And I think that that is because there's been a conflation, a confusion of sort of the cultural idea of Christmas and Santa and all of those sorts of things with, so that's gotten all mixed up with the Christian observance of this feast of Christmas. And so I think talking a little bit about what the difference between those two actually is and some reasons for those differences and some things to help you understand what the Christian Feast of Christmas is about will really help deepen and enrich your time as you walk through these next couple of weeks. So I'm excited for us to talk about it.
Well, I'm excited to hear, you know, your perspective, and maybe this was the case, but I can't remember a time where Christmas just didn't end after the 25th. It was always the case that the 26th was here and like half the Christmas trees were just thrown out, mainly because they were dead, it seemed like. Because they were put up at
Halloween.
Exactly. Yeah. And so we would go and get all those and go do a giant bonfire. It was so much fun. But it's hard for me to imagine. I mean, can you remember a time in your life where Christmas extended beyond the 25th?
Yes. I think a lot of it depends on the family that you grew up in. So in our family, we were very big on the whole idea of the 12 days of Christmas, and Christmas tree didn't usually go up until around the 20th or the 21st, stayed up all the way through Christmas. My parents always had a big 12th night party, which was sort of the end of Christmas right before Epiphany, and then on the Feast of Epiphany, we would have a big dinner with all these candles, which is a tradition with Epiphany, and then on January 7th, the tree and the decorations came down.
Yeah.
So I sort of grew up with that, so it didn't seem so strange to
me.
When do you
think it became very common, I guess, for whatever we're experiencing now, that it seems commercially driven, I guess, to me, that all of a sudden now they're on to the next inflatables in the, you know, whatever store they're, you know.
Yes.
So when do you think that really began to be the norm?
I think in the late 19th and 20th century, particularly in this country, that became the norm. And I also think that there was a misunderstanding of what Christmas was. And there's just been this push-pull about Christmas really ever since the 16th century in England. Mm. So one of the things probably many of you have heard, oh, Christmas actually wasn't December 25th. It was actually probably in the spring, and they actually assigned the date for Christmas to try to cover up this pagan feast. So you probably heard all that. The problem with that is actually not true. There are some scholars that think that, but If you go back and read in the early church fathers, going back as far as AD 70, 170, 200, December 25th was observed as the date of Christmas. And the reason for that is that if you have been in church, in an Anglican church or one that uses the same lectionary, you've heard about the miraculous birth of John the Baptist coming. And there's a lot of specificity about John the Baptist's birth because his father was a priest, and it talks about he was on duty in the temple, and we know what tribe he was, and that was a specific period of time. And so we know about when John the Baptist was born, and we know how that relates to when Jesus was born. And if you work the 9 months, it's December 25th. Yes. So there is some pretty good evidence for that. But the other thing that was interesting is there was a church council in the year 567. It's a long time ago. 567 in Tours. Who knows where Tours is? What country?
Oh, come on.
France?
Yes, there we go. Thank you.
Yes, it's in France. France was a robustly Christian country at one point in history. And the Council of Tours, they set the season of Christmas as a major feast period, a period of 12 days of feast. And the idea of that, you probably heard that in Christianity there are some days that are fast days, like Good Friday and Lent and Ash Wednesday and all that. But there also are feast days. And typically, Christians know more today about the fast days and those disciplines, but they don't really think about feasting. But so there, from 567 right on through, in Europe, it was absolutely common to observe the 12 days of Christmas. And even in France, which is pretty secular now, they still do this, and that is a national holiday on Christmas Day, but also on Epiphany. And most people are off that whole period. But we've just lost that in this country. And some of that is thanks to Oliver Cromwell. Do you know who Oliver Cromwell was?
I do. Lord protect me.
Who was he?
Well, that would have been England, right?
Yes.
This is 17th century. Didn't he become the one I'm blanking right now. But he was 17th century, yes, mm-hmm. in England. Mm-hmm. And basically overthrew the king, right?
Yes. Which king?
Charles the First.
Yes. Please give Justin a round of applause.
I have not been at school in so long. Oh, man.
And Charles the First beheaded, by Oliver Cromwell's forces, but he was succeeded by Charles the Second, and the noblemen that helped bring Charles the Second to the throne included Lord Anthony Ashley Cooper. That might sound familiar. They're the ones that founded Charleston. They were given Charleston and the Carolinas in return for helping bring the king back. But Oliver Cromwell was famous not only for these things, but for outlawing Christmas. He made it against the law to observe Christmas.
Sounds like a parenting ploy that's gone really bad. We're ending Christmas.
Yeah, no, it did not work out very well for him. He ended up losing his own head later. But one of the things that happened is there became a strain in some of the more Puritan traditions that Christmas was a bad thing and you shouldn't feast during Christmas. And so there's been this push-pull. And in the Massachusetts Bay Colony, there was some of that idea that you should not observe Christmas. So in this country, it's had more of a checkered past. But if you look at Christian tradition, there's a robust tradition that Christians should celebrate Christmas for this whole 12-day period and observe it as a time of feasting and joy and all of these kinds of things. But the problem is, for most of us, first of all, we don't know that. And the second thing is, even if we do know that, we don't know what that looks like.
So going back to Tours in France in the 500s, they actually feasted every single one of those 12 days? Mm-hmm. Like actually feasted?
Yeah.
I mean, were there other things that they did?
Yes. So they had more worship than usual. They had feast. They had singing. And then there was a Christmas Day was the big worship time, but there was worship each day of the week. And then Twelfth Night was a big party to celebrate sort of the end of that season, but leaning into Epiphany, which celebrates the gospel coming to the Gentiles on January 6th.
I think one of the things, too, is that for us, every day is a feast day in our culture. And so the idea of fasting seems, why would you deprive yourself of anything,
yep.
right? I mean, that's
yep.
the kind of what's in the air that we breathe now. And so setting up a rhythm of fasting and feasting seems not intuitive for,
yes.
I think, most of us.
Yes, I think that's right. And we tend to think feasting just means eating a lot. But that is not actually what it means. It does mean that you might have some special meals, but it means that you think of all the things that you feast on, all the things that bring you joy, whether it is family or friends or things that are beautiful or music or worship. All of those things are part of the idea of feasting. And how many of y'all have read or seen a production of A Christmas Carol? All right, that's pretty good. If you've never read A Christmas Carol or watched it, I would encourage you to do that. But one of the things that it is trying to remind us of is that the idea of feasting is associated with the idea of remembering. Any of y'all that have been in Prince Caspian class have heard us talk a lot about remembering, and this whole idea that remembering is really important and the Christian faith. And when you look in the scriptures, there are all these places where people are told to remember God's blessing in their life. And so, does anybody remember who the main character in A Christmas Carol is?
Scrooge.
Yes, Ebenezer Scrooge. What a great name. But Ebenezer was chosen for a very particular reason, because Ebenezer is a Hebrew word that shows up in the Old Testament, and it is the word that is used when Joshua brings the children of Israel across the Jordan River at flood stage into the Promised Land. And it's a big miracle from God. And so what Joshua commands them to do right after they've crossed the river and it's dry is to pick up these flat stones that are on the bottom of the river that normally you could never get to because there's all this water above it, to take those stones and to pile them as a monument on the Promised Land side to show God's faithfulness. And that pile of stones is called an Ebenezer. And so that's why Dickens chose that name for Scrooge, because as Scrooge goes back and is shown things by all these different ghosts and remembers, that is what drives him to realizing he has become utterly selfish and that he needs to change his heart and express what it means to experience the joy of feasting at Christmas. Can I read this little
excerpt?
Please. All right. This is a little excerpt from the end of A Christmas Carol. Oh, thank you. Wrong page. So he's just awakened from his last dream, and he says, "Now I have times to make amends for how I've lived. I'll live in the past, present, and the future." He repeated as he scrambled out of bed, "Heaven and the Christmas time be praised for this. I say this on my knees, on my knees." He went to church and walked about and watched people hurrying to and fro and patted children and looked down into kitchens and up the windows and found everything could yield him pleasure. He'd never dreamed that any walk, that anything could give him so much happiness. Scrooge was now better than his word. He did everything for Tiny Tim. Tiny Tim is the poor little boy who's on the verge of death because Scrooge wouldn't pay his father enough wages. He did everything for Tiny Tim, became his second father. He became as good a friend, as good a master, as good a man as the whole city knew. And it was always said of him that he knew how to keep Christmas well. May that be truly said of us and of all of us. And so, as Tiny Tim observed, God bless us, everyone. And that is the end of the story of A Christmas Carol. But the idea of it is that the feast of Christmas turns you away from being self-absorbed to experiencing joy because of the fact that God sent Jesus into the world, joy because you can give generously to others, joy because you can love the people that God has put in your life and be grateful for all of the blessings that you have. And that is so different from our cultural approach, because our cultural approach is, I'm going to make my Christmas list of what I want, and if I don't get what I want, maybe it's not such a good Christmas. Mm. And if you have any little children in your life, you probably have been there on Christmas morning when they opened their presents and they said, is that all? But all of us probably are thinking that. So. Yeah.
Well, that's interesting to think about, you know, living into those very things. I think that's important. How do you keep Christmas in this season of 12 days of Christmas in a way that is distinctly Christian, as opposed to kind of the, I do think that there's kind of like a general season of Christmas beginning after, you know, Thanksgiving or whatever, that goes all the way maybe to New Year's or something like that. It's just kind of winter and do good unto others and be thankful and grateful. I think there's that kind of secular notion of it, but what specifically in the Christian faith for those 12 days that separates it even from Epiphany or Advent that are helpful things for us to live into?
Yeah, so I think one of them is to be engaged in worship, whether that is being in an actual church service or just on your own and reading some of the scriptures about Christmas. Christmas hymns and Christmas carols are a huge resource for that, to actually, you can sing if you want to, but it's great to meditate on the words of those. Most of those are really theologically rich. Hark the Herald Angels Sing is one of the most profound, succinct statements of what the incredible blessing of Jesus is. It's a far cry from Grandma Got Run Over by the Reindeer. So I think leaning into worship, making space to be quiet. Christmas is still a time, you know, in Advent we've talked about lighting these candles that are part of our waiting. And in Christmas, we still light those candles and we have the white candle that represents Jesus' presence with us. And so you can still use, if you have an Advent wreath, use it during Christmas with all the candles lit. You might have to replace them. But also the white candle for Christmas, that can be a great thing to do. It's also a great time to consciously do what Jesus did, which was to serve others, to look for ways that you can serve others during Christmas, whether that be your family, but particularly people that are older or people that are children. Leaning into serving can be a really good thing to do. Leaning into gratitude, being outside. Charleston is a great place to be in that sort of environment, whether you go to the beach or go walk through a garden or, you know, whatever it might be, and spend some time just in prayer with that. But I think the key to all of it is being intentional and taking some time each day to say, this is a feast day, how am I going to lean into this? And that is not, I think, easy in our culture, because what usually happens is right after Christmas, it's the return frenzy of all the stuff that you got that you didn't want or that didn't fit, or the after Christmas sale frenzy. There's a lot of frenzy in that period. And I think consciously choosing to step away from that can be really good. And then going at the end of that season to an Epiphany service can be really good. St. Philip's is going to have an Evensong, which is a beautiful service on January 6th. It's also a great time to have a party, to invite your friends, to share hospitality with others, to share your joy in the season.
I'm so glad you said that. I was thinking very much about how intentional you kind of have to be to keep a good, wholesome celebration going, right? And this is a season not of just moving on to the next thing. I feel like so much of life is that very thing. You're just on to the next. You're worried about, you know, whatever the thing is on your calendar. But instead, to be intentional of going for over a week in terms of, I want to invite others into this celebration.
Yes.
Because you've prepared, right? In a sense, if you're following the calendar, you're going through Advent as you prepare yourself for the coming. And that anticipation, it's just so much richer when all of a sudden you're able to prolong that and continue it into the season of Christmas. And Epiphany is a great way to finish it as well.
Yes.
I appreciate that's
yes.
what your 12th night party that you've,
yep.
you've done before. I never even heard of that until we ended up going to your house
yep.
that time. It,
yep.
was lovely. So, I think that's a challenge in some ways because we're so just eager to just keep going on with
yes.
with life as it is.
But I think that sort of intentionality of leaning in, of practicing hospitality, and it's also a great time if you are a news junkie to just disconnect for that whole 12 days. Maybe go off social media, don't watch the news, just live in the present moment of feasting, because that can be transformative in and of itself.
So how do you do this if you also have to, like, I'm assuming these were like vacation days or something like that, and how do you do that in a climate where maybe you do have to work?
Yeah, so I think there are a number of things you can do. I think one of the best things, even if you have to work, is as you start each day before you go to work, to spend some additional time in prayer. In the Book of Common Prayer, there are these incredible collects for the season of Christmas that are these beautiful prayers. And those, they're on the internet if you don't have a prayer book. Those can be a beautiful thing to print those out and use one each day during the season. It will reorient your perspective. I also think planning things intentionally with other people after you get off work, or if you have a long lunch break. A lot of people's jobs, even if you have to work, things are usually slower during that period because so many people are on vacation, that you can do things like have lunch with a friend, or if you have an elderly relative that lives here, that might be the time to take that person to lunch or buy them a treat and take to their house or something like that.
One of the things too you printed off that I really like here is from the book Every Moment Holy. Anybody heard of the book Every Moment Holy? It gives little liturgies of ways that you can enter into different moments throughout something as mundane as the first snowfall of the
yep.
year. There's a liturgy. There's a liturgy is just a little formal way of putting words to what you're experiencing in something that you're in the moment, basically. And for celebrating, there's one called Feasting with Friends
yes.
that I've done, and it's
awesome.
It's so good.
It's so good.
It's like 3 pages, but it really does talk about, and we mentioned this back when we did one on feasting and fasting, but the importance of recognizing what the feast is a symbol of and what this points and drives us towards is in a real sense, eternity. And all of the goodness, all of the joy, all of the wrongs being made right, you catch a little glimpse of that
mm-hmm.
in the celebration of the feast. And this is such a great, I commend that book to you, but this, you can even print off just that liturgy, Feasting with Friends, if you Google
yeah.
it on there.
And we'll have it up here on the table if you want to just come take a picture of it. It is such a way of being able to articulate some of the things that you might want to say out loud, but feel like you don't have the words to do during the season. It can be a great aid for that. And if you have people for dinner during Christmas, it's just a really beautiful thing to be able to do. And part of the reason that this, I think, is good because it helps us to stop and engage with the momentousness of this season. If you were in Prince Caspian class last week, we talked a lot about the fact that C.S. Lewis, in his work, says that the incarnation, Jesus being born as a baby in Bethlehem, is the greatest miracle of all time, and that every other miracle and every other thing about the Christian faith all proceeds from that moment. And I think he's absolutely right about that, and said the more that you can spend time celebrating that and living into that, the more joy there will be.
I'm glad that you mentioned about doing this together. I think there's something that's so important about continuing the feast and the time of Christmas, that you're actually with others.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's all right, I do want to read just 2 lines of this, because you would never
yeah.
really say this unless you were given permission because somebody's right. telling you you need to say this. This is part of the liturgy that we're doing. But think about these words that that are true words.
Yeah, and imagine you're sitting at a table with friends with this.
That's beautifully decorated. Yeah. That's got candles and your goblets and everything. You raise a glass and you say, "May this shared meal and our pleasure in it bear witness against the artifice and deceptions of the prince of darkness that would blind this world to hope. May it strike at the root of the lie that would drain life of meaning and the world of joy and the suffering of redemption." I mean, that's just something that is so true and needs to be said. And we remind ourselves as we continue the celebration of Christmas that this is the true story that we're in.
Absolutely. And the other thing that can be a huge aid with all of this, we rail against technology in here from time to time, but one of the great blessings of technology is that you can listen to a world-class choir on YouTube singing just about any Christmas music that you could ever imagine. Listening to Handel's Messiah can be a beautiful thing. If that's too much of a deep dive for you, doing King's College Christmas carols, that's a great thing to listen to because the music of this season is some of the most beautiful music that has ever been written by humans. Mm-hmm. And leaning into that is a great way to fire your sense of wonder.
Did we ever do a tot on singing, just the importance of it?
I don't think
so. That would be something worth considering because I think I mean, you and I have talked about it before, but, you know, the practice of corporate singing mm-hmm. is very much, you know, unless you go to a Premier League soccer game or an Irish pub or a church, in some churches, it's not as much geared towards getting everyone to sing together. But where else do you find people actually singing together?
Right.
And thankfully, this time of year, as you talked about, offers some wonderful songs that are familiar enough, and I would encourage you, I'd even challenge you, to sing those together, because the words, again, are not only true, but there's something that happens when you sing.
Mm-hmm.
No, what is it? Is it praying twice? That's not right. That's not singing.
Yeah, he who sings prays twice.
Is that what Augustine said?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I was like, I thought that was something else. But that's true. Augustine did say singing is like praying twice, because you're filling your lungs with air that's needed. It takes this actual energy to be able to belt out something together. Even just trying to sing, it's different than just speaking it.
Yes.
And it takes root in you in a different way, but it joins you with others that is befitting for celebration.
Yeah.
So I challenge you, try singing some of these basic good Christmas hymns together.
Sounds
what
good.
Other final things should we throw before we throw it open to questions?
Would just say there's a great piece that C.S. Lewis wrote that is... It's sort of funny, but it's also sort of profound. That's on the internet if you want to look it up, and it's called A Lost Fragment of Herodotus, which doesn't sound like something that anyone would ever want to read. Herodotus being the ancient historian, but the idea of this thing is that it's supposed to be this historian looking at this nation that's called Nyaterb and trying to figure out what in the world is going on in this nation. And he observes that there are these two things happening simultaneously. One, which is called Xmas, which is all these people running around in a frenzy and buying cheap stuff to give to other people and sending all of these cards and then getting mad when they get a card from someone they haven't sent one to and then they feel like they've got to do that. So that's all going on and stressing everyone out. But then there's this other one that is called Christmas, where he says they get up early in the morning and with shining faces go and worship concerning this newborn baby. And he says it's such a contrast between the two. But it's very interesting to read. And Nyaterb is Britain backwards.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. But it is when you read it, it seems very applicable to what's going on today.
Yeah. So. All right, who we have moderating for us tonight?
Wes.
Awesome. I can't even see it. It's so dark.
I'm back here.
Hey, Wes.
This thing, can you hear me? My name's Wes. I'll be asking questions tonight. Looks like we have six. So if you guys want to ask away, I'll go ahead and get started. You guys ready?
Yep.
All right. Do you believe the historical accuracy of every Bible event is more important than the actual message of Scripture?
That's a good question. I don't think we've ever had that question.
No,
before.
I don't think we have either.
The historical accuracy of every biblical event? Is that what the question?
I can read it again. Do you believe the historical accuracy of every Bible event is more important than the actual message of Scripture?
I don't know how you would answer this one. I think, you know, they didn't actually, they told history in a different way, in the Old Testament in particular. The kind of precision that we expect in history in post-Enlightenment is not at all the way that they told history before. And that wasn't embellishment. That wasn't actually deception. That was actually just the way they told the story. So I do the way I would answer that question is I do think it's important that it's actually true. Like the things that you see in Scripture are in fact true. Sometimes the precision is not actually there, and that's not because the author's trying to deceive. But I do think it's important. I mean, nothing could be more important than the truth of the resurrection, and that this is not just the special meaning of joy is that Jesus is alive in our hearts. Like that, Paul says to something like that, that if he didn't rise physically from the dead, your faith is in vain. And so that's pretty strong words. I don't know, what would you add to that?
I would say that those are both sort of the same thing in a way. I think that you're absolutely right that what we think of as strict historical accuracy is not what the people who were, through the guidance of the Holy Spirit, writing the books of Scripture, that was not what their chief goal was. Their chief goal was to tell the story of what God was doing in the world. And so I would say Scripture is true, with a capital T, regardless of any historical discrepancies that there might be in there. And I would also say a lot of things that people think are historical discrepancies, the more and more archaeology that gets done, Scripture is coming out looking really good about its historical accuracy as well.
Yeah, it's hard to talk about. I'm sure there's maybe one or two things that whoever asked this question has in their mind about the historical inaccuracies. What comes to my mind is maybe their view of Genesis 1 and 2. Again, I don't think that the author's primary intent there was to describe the historical, exactly how it happened, but the truth that God, in fact, created. There's several different views of Genesis 1 and 2 that are Christian, that Christians themselves have understood. But I think, too, you get to like the flood or other events like that, and you got to consider, the genre. But I'd be curious, if you did ask this question, come talk to us, because talking in the abstract can be challenging here.
Yes, and I would say, you know, some things, like there's a lesson that usually gets read around this time of year from the Gospel that is talking about when Jesus was born, and it lists like all of these Roman officials that have impossible to pronounce names like Trachonitis and things like that. And originally there were a lot of scholars that doubted all of this, but those things have actually all been proven, that all of those people were actually in place at exactly that time. So
yeah, things like the Dead Sea Scrolls and all this stuff are only proving more and more what the church in many ways has believed in the New Testament.
All right. Which aspect of Christmas do you think is most distorted from its original meaning?
I would say the commercialism Santa. Part of it and the gift giving, because it has gotten crazy. So this whole idea that you have to spend lots and lots of money, and that there's this whole frenzy of trying to get people, and people having all their lists of what they want and all of that, that is so distorted from the original meaning of Christmas. And the idea, the gifts that are originally given in Christmas, of course, are gifts that are brought to Jesus. And I think the idea of having glad and generous hearts is a beautiful thing, and that if the gift giving is proceeding out of a sincere desire to joyfully bless someone by giving them something, that's a beautiful thing. But if it's, I've got this list of 20 people that if I don't get them something, they're going to be mad, that is not in accord with the original meaning of Christmas, I would say.
I kind of tongue-in-cheek said Santa, but, I mean, Saint Nick, that is a historical person, right? And slapped Arius the heretic, which
That's
is
right.
great. But
punched him.
Yeah, he punched him. Okay. But I think, you know, he sees you when you're sleeping. He knows when you're awake. I mean, some of that is, like, wildly wrong. And
do you think?
Yeah, that. So I would say that's distorted. It's so easy to go off the rails and to just untether things from their original intent. I would say instead of asking the question, what's the furthest thing away? It's like, I would rather just try to get closer to what is the essence and what is the thing that was the origin of Christmas in the first place. And you're talking about the gifts. Like, I have nothing against, you should actually give gifts. You should spend time with family and serve others. All those are great things. But as you pointed out, the gifts that are given, it's actually worship that's happening
right.
at that time.
Yeah.
And so remembering, again, the person of Jesus. And I think that's something, and we don't really talk much about that, but you could read, like, one of our favorite books to read, Athanasius's
yes.
On the Incarnation. You can
so
do
good.
That in 12 days pretty easily. But there's so much just gold in contemplating who this person is, that God would become a man. It's life-changing. And the fact that he would do that to save us, and that he would know what it's like to experience human frailty and suffering, to draw near to us, like, those are incredible truths that, you know, I would much rather try to focus on that than all the other ways that you can go away from that.
Yes. And I would commend, if you haven't watched the Charlie Brown Christmas special lately, that is a good thing to watch. That, I don't know if you know the backstory to that, but that was commissioned by the Coca-Cola company back in the 1960s, and they were busy, so they didn't, like, really pay a lot of attention to what was happening, and they had no idea that Charles Schulz was going to do this, like, gospel polemic, where the whole thing culminates with Linus actually reading out loud the entire chapter from Luke's gospel about Christmas and saying that's what the meaning of Christmas is, and they had scheduled the whole thing to be broadcast, and then people in power found out, like, what it was, and they were like, we can't do this, but it was too late. They couldn't stop it, and so they thought it's going to absolutely bomb, and all these people are going to hate it, and all of the expert reviewers said this is going to be the worst thing, and Coca-Cola is going to have a black eye from it, and in fact, the complete opposite happened, and they never got more positive feedback than when they did that. But the whole point of that show is about the meaning of Christmas is Jesus, which, yeah, the fact that that's on television still every year is pretty amazing.
That is amazing. So good. Next one.
What is your favorite Christmas movie, and how does it capture the true essence of the season?
That question depends on what hour you ask me, because I vacillate a lot, but I would say probably I land mostly on It's a Wonderful Life. There are aspects of It's a Wonderful Life that are really wrong theologically. The whole theology of angels in that movie is, like, totally off. But there's a lot that's really right about that movie, and so, and I think part of what it does is to focus you on the significance of and the gift and beauty of life, but also the impact that one person's life can have, and then sort of beyond that, extrapolating the impact of Jesus's life.
I was just going to say Home Alone, but Home Alone 5 or 7, whatever.
Yes.
Macaulay Culkin, whatever his one. Yeah.
Yes.
No, Die Hard, obviously. There we go.
Justin. Now, what's really your favorite?
I like those. It's a Wonderful Life is a good one. I don't know. I probably would say A Christmas Carol, because I love that story. And again, you've already talked about Ebenezer, but I don't know. I'm not, like, just I have to watch certain movies every year.
Yeah. Well, I will give a plug for, if you have time and can afford it, going to see A Christmas Carol at the Dock Street Theater is really a great thing to do.
Oh, wow.
Thank you.
Wow.
This is amazing.
Thank you. Is this from you? All right. Fantastic.
So A Christmas Carol at Dock Street Theater is really great. They have adapted the play and put a lot of Christmas carols in it, so it is very full of Christian theology, and you know, it's a beautiful theater to begin with, so yeah. It's a great thing to do.
Yeah.
Awesome. How do you recommend doing Santa, Christmas/Santa with your children?
Have we talked about this?
No.
Oh, I can't wait to hear what you would say.
Well, you're the one who has little children.
You've
now.
Got children. You've done this before, but I will tell you the way we've done it. We have leaned less into, you know, building up Santa. We have talked about, like, you know, the story of Santa and the myth of Santa, all that stuff. We've also talked about St. Nicholas. We've kind of just done the whole shebang. But again, for us, it's whatever your norm is what most forms those in your household, I think. And so for us, the norm was always, we're going to church, and we're going to talk about Jesus. We're going to celebrate Jesus' birthday. This is really important. And we're going to give gifts, not only because we honor God, but we love one another. And it's a time of celebration. Any birthday, you have gifts that are given. And so, yeah, I think I like, especially in the earlier ages, the imagination. I mean, that's one of the things that's fun. All this elf on the shelf stuff just annoys me because, like, even my four-year-old's, like, you know, over it right now. But I don't know. Basically, our kids, it's turned really sweet where, you know, when they were, like, 6, 7, 8, something like that, they started to basically realize that, like, mom and dad were, if they're listening, they don't ever listen to this, so it's not fun. But if they're, like, they're going to, like, help out. That'd be so funny if the four-year-old's listening to Tot. But... No, she's basically, like, they help out with making it special and kind of a wonderful experience for the kids. But how'd you navigate that?
So we did sort of the same thing in that the focus in our house was always around Christmas worship. And one of the big things was that when you got to be 5 years old, that meant, this is before I was a priest, it would be impossible to do this now, but when you got to be 5, that I would take you, and it would be just the two of us, and go to the late Christmas service just on our own, which was an amazing experience to get to do with each of my kids. But we also had Santa, but we didn't make Santa the focus of everything. So Santa would bring what was in the stockings, and usually Santa would bring one thing for each child. And then at some point, when they had sort of figured it out, we would sit down with them and talk about Santa as a metaphor for the beautiful and incredible generosity of God in sending Jesus, and that it was a way to learn about that and experience the joy of that.
Let's see. How did the tradition of the creche or the nativity scene start, and is too much importance placed on it in both secular and religious contexts?
I have no clue the answer to this question.
Might have said that.
I got your back. So the creche is something that really came to the fore in Italy during the medieval period, and St. Francis of Assisi was the main one who sort of breathed life into that. And that time period became one where people, through that recreation of the manger scene, it was part of what it was designed to do was to bring people in contact with the earthiness of that scene, that Jesus was not born in a palace, that there were animals and a manger, and it smelled bad, and, you know, all of that. And so that is where the tradition came from. And then out of that grew where it got sort of over the top and became this gorgeous, like, 14-karat gold figures and all of that kind of thing, which was obviously not the original intent. But I think that still, if you've never been to a live manger scene, and there are still some places that do that, that can be a very moving experience. For a while, I don't know if they're still doing it, Northbridge Baptist Church here was doing that, and it is very well done the way that they do it out there. And so I think that it is something that can be helpful. We do have a very simple manger scene in our house that we put out each year, and the tradition is that the youngest child that's around always puts Jesus in the manger on Christmas morning. So it's a great thing to be able to teach into with that. So I'm not opposed to it, but I think having one of those $15,000 nativity scenes is probably a little much.
A little bit much, yeah. We didn't really talk about, like, again, those are helpful things because they're illustrative, they're teaching tools. And, one of the things that we're actually doing this year to try to prolong Christmas is we're not decorating our tree until Christmas Eve.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one
way.
That's
what people used to do.
Is that what they used to
do?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Our oldest child is absolutely up in arms about it right now. She is about to just throw everything. She's like, I'm just going to decorate it. You're not even going to stop me. But part of it is we want to just continue on. And mm-hmm. so utilizing the creche, utilizing a full tree that's decorated, like making that special, are wonderful teaching aids for children in particular.
Yeah.
Okay. Why does there seem to be more emphasis on the what of Christmas, being that Christ was born, rather than the why, which is to save sinners? Is this due to secularization?
That's a great question. I think it depends on who you're talking about making the emphasis. I think the cultural emphasis is definitely use Jesus as a way to enhance sales, basically. But I think in the church, there's a lot about the why, in the preaching and in the scripture lessons and all of that. So I think the what obviously is important, but if you have just the what without the why, it's kind of empty.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if any secular folks are doing this. If you're actually talking about Jesus at all, by and large, he became man. God became man in Christ. That's what is actually happening. So the what is there, and the why. I mean, it's right there in the beginning of Matthew's gospel. You shall call him Jesus, for he will save them from their sins. So I think it's. I don't know if I relate so much to the person asking the question. I feel like of the people that are talking about Jesus, the what and the why seem to be held close together in my experience. But it's important to hold both of those together. And it's not just that, God became a man. He came to actually save us, indeed.
Right.
And to raise up, our fallen nature and to sanctify that. But to also experience the depth of what we've done, to be able to live the perfect life and die in our place so that we could be forgiven.
Yeah, and that's another thing that's great about Christmas carols is they usually hold those together. I mean, a lot of them, like you probably heard the Christmas carol, What Child Is This? Well, one of the verses in the original version of that is, nails spear shall pierce him through the cross he bore for me, for you. It's pointed, hail, hail, the word made flesh, all of that. So the whole idea of ransoming sinners is right there.
Yeah.
What is your favorite Christmas moment or feast from the Narnia series?
Oh, that's a hard question. Let me just first say that the Narnia series, you could sort of put a frame over all of it and say all of the Narnia series is about Advent and the Incarnation, because almost every book in Narnia, you're waiting for Aslan's return. And that is part of Advent, that we're looking toward the second coming of Christ. But one of the beautiful things in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is that refrain that's always going to be where the evil enchantment has made it always winter, but never Christmas. And I think the most beautiful Christmas moment in that story is when the children and the beavers are running for their lives because they think they are being pursued by the evil white witch on her sleigh, and they're hearing the bells of the sleigh, and they're running and running and running, and they hide, and then the sleigh stops and they think they're about to be killed, and instead it's Father Christmas who has come. And Father Christmas brings them gifts that help each of them to accomplish the quest that they're on. If they didn't use those gifts, the White Witch would never have been defeated. But the most beautiful thing that happens is in the midst of that cold and barren winter, and this is a very British sort of thing, the last thing that Father Christmas pulls out is a complete tea service with hot tea and milk and sugar and cups and all of that. And out in this frozen wilderness, they have tea. And that is a beautiful Christmas moment.
So one that comes to my mind, and I can't remember which book that it's in, but when they're actually, I think it's towards the beginning of one of the books. Maybe it's Caspian, but they're in Cair Paravel. They're in the castle, and they're at a feast. Do you? Am I making this up? Which one is
it's
that?
It's not Prince Caspian.
Okay. It's not that one. Well, I would say one of those seven Narnia stories I remember reading where, what is the like third or fourth one?
Depends on how you're counting.
Do the one that you, the way you count them. Come on. You've got the
Voyage
Magician's
of the
Nephew.
Treader.
Yeah, is that?
If they're in Cair Paravel, it's probably The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
No, I know that one really well. All
right, well, what happens?
That's not it. But anyways, just the description of them in the castle, and they're around all of, like, the armor, and they're feasting, but then they end up going out on, I think it was to, maybe it was, I forgot what you just said a moment ago, the actual one, but I think for me, that image of feasting in the royal hall, right, is not so much Christmas related, but it is the fact that we feast on these major celebrations of the year. There's nothing more wonderful to me than thinking about the royal feast that awaits Christians in the heavenly banquet. So that's a long way of getting there, but that's what
it's
I was thinking
good.
Of.
Yeah. All right.
All right, maybe one more.
Do
we have one more?
Yeah. How should we handle criticism gracefully as believers?
How about that? That's a good one.
That is a most excellent question. What you should not do is to react with anger and tell the person off, which is what our culture very often does and models. But I think one of the best things, if you are receiving criticism and it is in a one-on-one type of situation, is to pray silently that God would open your heart to hear any truth that might be in this. Depending on the way that the criticism is offered and who is offering it, you might thank the person for caring about you enough to share this with you and say, I will certainly consider what you've said and pray about it. I think so much of it depends on what it is that's being said and who's saying it about how you respond. But responding in anger or dismissing it are things that are not helpful.
Yeah, I think recognizing, the scriptures give us a view of ourselves that we're inherently worthy by being made in God's image, and yet we're fallen. And so we recognize we should expect criticism if we're broken, selfish people. And so I think you're wise in saying you need to listen through what's being said to see what here is actually true. And having a receptivity in your heart when somebody is offering criticism. You know, I was trying to find, I know it's in Proverbs, but you have answer a fool according to his folly, and then don't answer a fool according to his folly in the same chapter of Proverbs. And what he's saying there is that there may be times that you should actually answer a fool who is saying something if it is, if it's exposing kind of the ridiculousness of this person. And then there's other times where if they're offering folly or criticism, that you just shouldn't engage whatsoever. So I do think there's some wisdom that's needed for engaging that. But recognizing that, okay, I should expect somebody, if they truly love me, not just to remain silent when I've done something wrong, but to come along, and again, how it's done makes all the difference.
Yeah, speaking the truth in love.
But I think particularly, even when it's done poorly, I don't know about you, but like when somebody has clearly like just been they could have delivered it in a nicer way. I think one of the things that's important is to remain, to go to the Lord with this
and say,
Lord, what, even though this really hurt my feelings and somebody was not gracious, what here is of you and that you're trying to teach me?
And not be defensive.
And not be defensive.
Yeah.
And that still that doesn't excuse the person who's not being gracious, but it does help you want to be the kind of gracious person who can be give constructive criticism going forward.
Yeah.
But, anyways, so... All right, well, thanks so much for coming out. This has been a lot of fun. You'll be around. I have to scoot to go pick up my daughter right now.
Yes.
So, but
thanks for coming.
You.
We'll be back in January. Watch your email. If you have not signed up for our email list with that QR code, please do that, and then you will be in the know. All right, thanks
Wonderful.
For coming.
Thanks.